Testing. Good. Well, good evening, everyone. Nice to see y'all, those of you who've made it. Merry Christmas, belated. Tonight we are continuing our study through Mark. So far we have seen Jesus the King, who triumphed over evil spiritual forces. We've seen Jesus the King restoring and renewing those who were broken and sick and needed to be delivered. We've seen Jesus the King establishing the kingdom with power and authority. And we've learned about how the kingdom that Jesus brought was maybe different from or upside down from what a lot of people expected. Tonight we're going to talk about Jesus the King establishing his kingdom and some ways that Jesus the King and his kingdom were a little different from what the religious leaders of the day expected, and then therefore they became kind of a chief opponent to Jesus. So by my count, Jesus encounters religious leaders in the first 8 chapters of Mark 9 times. That's what this table is. This is also the table, a version of the table that Victor sent out by email. So if you'd like to pull that one up on your phone or whatever, you can do that. That is an authorized use of technology during church. So Jesus, I think, by my count, encountered these religious leaders 9 times in the first 8 chapters. These leaders included scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees. Basically, all of these leaders were working very hard to establish a sort of Jewish religious autonomy within the kind of context of Roman rule. So they were pushing back against the secularization of the Greeks and the Romans and working to establish Jewishness, Jewish religious customs and ceremonial purity in the midst of that kind of political system. They hoped that eventually that Messiah would come, that he would sit on the throne of David, his father, that he would take back political authority from Rome, that he would establish an autonomous Jewish state that would then be, ruled and, operated just like Israel did under the Mosaic Law early on in their history. And that's what the Pharisees and Sadducees were really hoping for. Specifically, the Pharisees, there are some like technical differences between the Pharisees and Sadducees, which is not relevant for our conversation tonight. But the Pharisees specifically were really interested in ceremonial purity and establishing holiness. And so they worked to develop traditions and customs and practices and ways of living that basically protected the people from even accidental, like, breaking of the law. And their goal was, let's fully 100% keep the law. If we can just get everyone to keep the law, Messiah will come, right? That was basically the goal of the Pharisees. I found in some cases, some Pharisees believed that even if Israel, all Israel, would keep the Sabbath correctly one time, Messiah would come. So this is kind of the thrust of the Pharisees. Let's just get the people keeping the law, and Messiah will come and bring the kingdom, and it'll be great, right? That's what they're going for. But of course, Messiah came, and they weren't excited to see him, right? Like, he wasn't what they expected. He was so utterly different from what they expected that they missed him. They rejected him as Messiah. So I want to suggest tonight that in these first 8 chapters of Mark, in these interactions between Jesus and the Pharisees, we see Jesus the King ministering to the unclean, extending mercy, and modeling humility. And we see Jesus the King kind of contrasted with the religious leaders of the day in each of those ways. So that's our outline for tonight. And I think the next slide has that in case you forget where we are. Okay. So, number one, Jesus the King ministered to the unclean. Ceremonial purity was really important to the Jews, and especially the Pharisees. They would have carefully avoided coming into contact with anyone who was unclean, because the uncleanness of that unclean person would make them unclean for a time, and they would have to go through ritual purification before they could go to temple and so on. So, there were many ways that somebody could be made unclean according to the law of Moses. And the Pharisees were very concerned about all of those things. One of these would have been, in one of the kinds of unclean people that the Pharisees were concerned about, were the tax collectors and sinners, right? They were very concerned that Jesus associated with tax collectors and sinners. The king that the Pharisees expected would never have been caught dead eating with or associating with the tax collectors and sinners, unclean people. The king that the Pharisees expected would have kept himself clean by avoiding all of that kind of uncleanness. And so the Pharisees themselves would have kept away from sinners and other sorts of ceremonially unclean until those people had cleaned themselves up, and then they would have been, fit to associate with the Pharisees and fit to be considered for admittance into the kingdom, right? The Pharisees were kind of interested in this, like Matt was saying a couple weeks ago, they were interested in this outside-in sort of establishment of the kingdom. They were looking for cleaned up kind of outsides and tidied behaviors before they would consider people, part of, the in crowd, part of the kingdom. But Jesus was completely different from this expectation. He regularly associated with people who were unclean, and we see this all through this first section of Mark. So we've already mentioned Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners. Jesus not only spent time with or was in the vicinity of people like tax collectors and sinners, but he actually shared meals with them, which in this culture was a special activity of significance, and it indicated a closeness, an intimacy. So for Jesus to actually share a meal with sinners was kind of a big deal. It wasn't something that he would have done casually. So the king that the Pharisees expected would never have eaten with sinners. He would have eaten with people like the Pharisees, who had already had their lives cleaned up and were already, behaving in holiness according to the law, right? But Jesus humbled himself and ate even with sinners like tax collectors. And we see that all through Mark. Jesus also regularly interacted with people who were unclean because of illness. You can maybe immediately call to mind lots of examples of that, but one of the first examples of Jesus healing miracles in Mark is his healing of a man with leprosy. And leprosy was especially unclean, right? Of all of the things that could make somebody unclean, leprosy was one of the very much so. So somebody who had leprosy would have to actually live outside the camp so that they wouldn't get other people sick with leprosy. It was a really significant, highly contagious, very, very bad disease. And if they did walk around and come close to other people, they would have to yell out, unclean, unclean. They'd have to shout out that they were unclean so that people would know to avoid them, right? And so you have this unclean leper coming up to Jesus and saying, I will, or sorry, you can heal me. He knew that Jesus could heal him if he would. And Jesus said that he would make him clean. And Jesus touched him, which is so significant, right? Because by touching anything that was unclean, you yourself would be made unclean, right? And I think Dan talked about this whoever knows how many weeks ago, when he was talking about the power of the king, right? Jesus wasn't made unclean by touching that which was unclean. He actually made it clean. And I think that's remarkable, right? That's part of the power of the king coming into the situation. So Jesus wasn't afraid for his own holiness or his own cleanness, or his reputation, right? He didn't care what people thought about him for touching the leper and making him clean. He went and he touched the leper. He had compassion on him, and he healed him and made him clean. And then thirdly, Jesus interacted with or associated with or was in context with Gentiles. This one is interesting. The Pharisees seem to be, and others seem to be kind of bent out of shape about this. But all through the Old Testament, it's pretty clear that Israel was supposed to, minister to the Gentiles. So I suspect that somewhere along the lines there, it became maybe a tradition or a custom for them to keep very separated from Gentiles and consider them sort of unclean in a way as well. But Jesus, the king, extended mercy to the Gentiles as well, right? I think the Pharisees saw the Gentiles as the enemy, and Jesus, the king that the Pharisees expected, would have maybe kicked all the Gentiles out or something. I don't know exactly how that would have worked out for them. But Jesus, the king, extended the kingdom and invited even the Gentiles into the kingdom, right? We have the story of the Syrophoenician woman who says, you know, even the dogs eat the scraps that fall under the table. And Jesus, heals her daughter because of her faith, right? So, the king the Pharisees expected would never in his life have associated with uncleanness. And so the Pharisees were like, Jesus can't be the king. He can't be the Messiah because he's eating with tax collectors and sinners, and he's touching these people who are unclean. So, you know, clearly he can't be the king. And that's a really profound way that Jesus the king was different from what they expected. Jesus the king also extended love, compassion, and mercy as he taught the law. The Pharisees, in their teaching of the law, made it a tool of oppression, a burden, and a stumbling block. Jesus says that they made the law so difficult for people to bear, and they didn't even lift a finger to help them bear it. They made it this great burden and didn't lift a finger to help people bear it. In Matthew 23, he has this kind of tirade against the Pharisees, and it's a rich text if you'd like to consider more. For your extra credit reading on the Pharisees is in Matthew 23. Jesus said that they searched the whole world for a disciple, and when they found one, made him twice the child of hell as they were themselves. He said that they themselves would not go into the kingdom, and that they would suffer nobody else to go into the kingdom too, right? Like they are such an obstacle, a burden, an impediment to people coming into the kingdom. And they kind of do that through their teaching of the law. And not just through the teaching of the law itself, like the law of Moses, which, you know, we can pick up and read that in our Bibles as well. But they added to it their own traditions and customs. And they taught those customs as if they were the law. I think part of the goal of that, kind of adding customs and traditions that they kind of enforced, again, as I mentioned earlier, they really wanted everyone to keep the law, and they wanted nobody to, like, accidentally break the law, because if we were accidentally breaking the law, then we weren't holy, and Messiah wouldn't come, right? I think threaded through all of their stuff was this desire for holiness, and to establish, you know, to see Messiah come and establish the kingdom. Obviously they went about it the wrong way. They kind of missed some things in there and so on. Maybe just a quick aside, right? Like, it's easy to caricaturize the Pharisees as like this arch nemesis of Jesus or something. But they weren't like criminal masterminds. They were trying to establish the kingdom, and they wanted to see Messiah come, right? And I guess, spoiler alert, I think it's actually easier to be a Pharisee than we might think from reading through the Gospels. So let's not be too quick to pass judgment on the Pharisees for their Pharisaicalness, right? Okay, back to the script, right? Okay, a really key example of how the Pharisees added stuff to the law is in their teaching on the Sabbath. I'm not a rabbinic scholar. I'm also not like I haven't memorized the Old Testament yet, right? So I'm not sure if this is exhaustive or not, but I only found basically six examples of specific things that the people of Israel were not allowed to do on the Sabbath. And those things included doing work out of Exodus 20 and 31, kindling a fire out of Exodus 35, gathering sticks out of Numbers 15, farming for profit in Nehemiah 13, buying and selling in Nehemiah 13, and bearing burdens in Jeremiah 17. And so that's not a super comprehensive list of things, right? And the Pharisees basically filled in the gaps around, you know, those prohibitions. And they added, according to a kind of a modern day Orthodox Jewish website that I found, maybe this is like a rogue Orthodox Jewish website, I don't know. I don't know that much about like Orthodox Judaism in the modern day, so maybe take this with a grain of salt. I have cited my sources, and I can provide that to you if you're interested in chasing it down. But they listed 39 specific categories of work that were forbidden on the Sabbath. 39 specific categories of work. And it's like, it's an exhaustive list, right? Like, it's comprehensive. They've filled in the gaps, and they've listed specifically, all of these things are not allowed on the Sabbath day. And they're extra. That's not, these are not things that are specifically mentioned in the Law of Moses, right? So I think that's interesting, right? This is an example of how the Pharisees are kind of filling in the gaps, adding stuff to the law, and then expecting everyone to keep that, right, in this quest for holiness and for Messiah to come. So anyway, some of the things that they added are cooking, washing, and harvesting. And harvesting I thought was interesting because that's maybe where they're criticizing the Pharisees for plucking grain on the Sabbath day, right? Like, oh, that's not something that's allowed, right? If you look at the Old Testament, I don't see a prohibition about plucking grains, right? So I think that was an example of their traditions that they've put on people here. Furthermore, right, like they're teaching the law, they're adding their own traditions, they're requiring people to live according to those traditions and customs. But as Jesus criticizes in several places, some of their traditions actually subvert the point of the law to begin with, right? Like it's not even helping people live according to the heart of the law. It's actually undermining like the whole point of the law to begin with. So an example of this, as Jesus points out, is where the Pharisees have created kind of a loophole for children to not have to really honor their parents. If they say it is a gift, they don't have to honor their parents in a particular way. And so the Pharisees have kind of, according to their traditions, created some space for the people of Israel to not actually fulfill the law and live in a way that was honorable to their parents. And that's backwards, right? That undermines the heart of the law. So these customs, again, likely intended to facilitate holiness, establish a more holy community, and, you know, usher in the Messiah who would establish the kingdom. In reality, they subverted the law and they created a disconnect between the way that people lived and the actual condition of their heart, right? And that's maybe where Jesus kind of takes them to task, right? Like it's about the heart. As Matt mentioned a couple weeks ago, the kingdom of heaven is in the heart. And that's, again, maybe what the Pharisees, something the Pharisees missed. Jesus obviously didn't abide by their traditions. The Pharisees criticized the disciples for plucking grain on the Sabbath day, which is something that was a no-no according to their traditions. And Jesus says, he kind of shatters their paradigm and says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, right? I just imagine them kind of like speechless, kind of not really sure how to respond to that, right? Because it's completely different from what they expect and what their framework can even input, right? So in their zeal to keep the law, they missed the point of the law, which was to create a community where people were devoted to God and diligently caring for one another. Jesus speaks about this at length in Matthew 23. He criticizes the Pharisees for appearing righteous on the outside, but inside being filled with extortion, excess, and iniquity. He says they're hypocrites, and this Greek word, hypocrite, which is translated hypocrite, here literally means an actor, like in a stage play, somebody who would put on a mask, like dress up in a costume, and play a role, right? He's saying the Pharisees have put on this mask of righteousness, but inwardly they're prideful and selfish and full of iniquity and using other people for their own gain. The king the Pharisees expected would have upheld their code of conduct, lived according to their traditions, and he would have required all of his disciples to do that as well. But Jesus overturned their traditions and their interpretation of the law and instead taught and demonstrated a law-keeping that was characterized by love and mercy, which was, again, the point of the law to begin with. And this is clear in Jesus' answer to the scribe who asks him about the greatest commandments in Mark 12. Jesus answered him and said, the first of the commandments is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And the second is like, namely this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these. And the scribe responds, yes, you've spoken truly. And to do these is greater than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices, right? The scribe recognizes that that's the point, is to love God and love one another. And that's what God is driving at here. That's the whole point, right? We could talk a lot more about the law and grace and, you know, Jesus and the Pharisees and so on, but we don't. This is not a sermon series on the Pharisees, right? This is just one measly, supposedly 35-minute teaching. Okay, Jesus, third point, Jesus the King modeled humility. So he modeled this upside-down authority structure in the kingdom. Matt talked about the upside-down kingdom a few weeks ago, where the kingdom itself was vastly different from what people expected it to be, right? In Jesus' kingdom, greatness is characterized by servanthood. It's not characterized by, or it's not similar to what people in that day would have thought of as greatness, right? The Pharisees had a good thing going. They had a pretty comfortable life. They were, according to historical accounts, they were highly influential. I saw, in doing a little bit of background research on the Pharisees, I saw some historical accounts that they were as or more influential than the chief priests, and that they could actually turn people against the chief priests. So they were supposedly like common people and had a lot of rapport with the common people, as opposed to like the Sadducees, who were more like elite and so on. That's an aside. Anyway, all this to say, highly influential, they enjoyed a lot of respect, they had this prestige, they had this influence among the people. Maybe a modern day, not necessarily a modern day religious analog, but you know, we have a lot of influencers in our modern culture, right? There's a lot of people who can say something or do something or product place something online and immediately shift markets and whatever, right? What I've been told is the saying is that anything Taylor touches turns to gold. Is this right? Are you familiar with this? Perhaps Taylor Swift apparently can like wear a particular like shoe, and then it'll fly off the shelves because everyone wants to be like Taylor, right? Or I saw in the news Elon Musk tweeted something about the spending bill, and within a day it was dead, right? Like he told everyone to call their representatives and shut down this bill, and everyone did. I think actually Andy Barr was quoted in the article that I noticed, that I read, and he said his phone was ringing off the hook because everyone was responding to this influencer online. I shouldn't call Elon Musk an influencer. Highly influential person online, like highly powerful person, right? He said, everyone go and call your representative and shut this down. And they did, right? Like he had a tremendous amount of influence. And that's not to say that the Pharisees were influencers in the same sense, but they did have a tremendous amount of influence. They did have a tremendous amount of power and authority. And that's kind of how authority worked in that day. That's how it still works, right? Like in the kingdom of the world, right? Like it's still kind of modeled the same way. So anyway, the Pharisees enjoyed that. They had places of prominence in feasts in the synagogue. They used their power and authority to gain more wealth, more power, more prestige, and they expected the king to come to do the same. That's the way that all kings of the earth worked, right? There would be no reason that the king that was coming would not follow that pattern. But Jesus didn't, right? Like he completely overturned that. He could not have been more different from what they expected in this sense, right? Instead of taking political power, he refused and rejected it. In John 6, we read about this one encounter where Jesus noticed that the crowd was, he was concerned that they would take him and make him king. And so he just like leaves, goes away by himself, right? And avoids, he doesn't let them take him and make him king. All throughout Mark, we have examples of Jesus healing people and casting out demons, telling people to not share the word, like not say what he has done to them, right? That always was really confusing to me. Like, why did Jesus not want everyone to go and talk about how amazing he was, and that here, look, Jesus the Messiah is here. You know, he healed me, he cured my blindness, he cast this demon out. I never really understood it until Gary, I don't remember his last name, but Gary from Indiana came down and gave us that workshop last year on Jesus and his mission. And he explained that Jesus was really trying to, his mission was to die on the cross, right? And he knew that if the people, if he gathered this huge following and the people made him the king in a political sense, that would actually get in the way of his mission, which always from the beginning was to go to the cross, right? That was the real victory. That was the way that he was actually going to bring about the kingdom and the earth. And he protected his mission by not letting people talk about him, right? That was part of that. But I think it's so interesting, right? Like Jesus could have been an influencer, you know? Imagine if somebody today, you know, well, you don't have to imagine. You don't have to try that hard to imagine. People, you know, quickly can develop followings by if miracles are attributed to them, right? Like, and I think a lot of times, most of the time, that kind of falls apart. But you can see the kind of influence that somebody can have just by the miraculous, right? Jesus could have milked that. He could have leaned into that and established political power through that influence with the people. And with a word, he could have told his followers to all go, I don't know, kill a Roman soldier or something. And he could have overthrown Rome in Judea. He could have established an autonomous Jewish state and sat on the throne of his father David and brought them back to the Mosaic law, just like the Pharisees expected. He totally could have done that. Obviously, he didn't. This is another aside in my research on the Pharisees. I found some modern day like rabbinic teachings that say, of course Jesus wasn't the Messiah because he didn't establish the kingdom, in the sense that they were expecting, right? So that's actually not just like an outdated idea of the Pharisees in Jesus' day. It's actual like rabbinic teaching. Jesus couldn't have been the Messiah because he didn't establish the kingdom in the way that they were expecting. Okay, back to the script. He could have used his miracles, gained a huge following, and been what they expected, just like Taylor could have, you know, touched a purse and made it fly off the shelves. But he set that aside, you know, because his goal was to go to the cross. And this was really difficult for the disciples to understand. All through Mark, we see them arguing with one another about who would be greatest. Actually, in all the Gospels, we see that, right? They're arguing with one another about who will be greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus, over and over again, is trying to help them understand that greatness in the kingdom of heaven is different. You know, it's not sitting at the highest place in the feast. It's not having a position of, like, prominence and prestige, right? It's getting on your knees and serving the people next to you, right? And Jesus models this. He walks in humility his entire time on earth. He humbles himself daily by working diligently to heal the people around him, teach people, train his disciples, like with patience and long suffering, you know, and casting out demons, you know, doing all that. I imagine that was very tiring and maybe not particularly fulfilling work for Jesus to do, right? I have small children. I know like how difficult it can be to train my small children. So, you know, Jesus could have had all the authority that he wanted, but he sets that aside and he humbles himself and models that humility in the kingdom. So if you're like me, you've probably wondered how the Pharisees could have missed Jesus the king. They would have had the Old Testament just about memorized. You'd think that when Jesus came and he showed all the signs, the miracles and so on, he fulfilled all these prophecies, you'd think that would have been pretty clear to them. And so maybe you're kind of like scratching your head over how they would have missed him, right? I think it's just that they were so confident in like the particulars about what Jesus and the kingdom would have looked like, what the king and the kingdom would have looked like, that when Jesus came and he was different, you know, even though he showed all of this evidence that he was who he said he was, they weren't able to, it's like they couldn't compute it, right? Because it was so different from their expectations. And rather than lay down their expectations, you know, and follow Jesus, because he obviously was who he said he was, they rejected Jesus because he didn't conform to their expectations, right? And I think that should be a warning. There's a warning in there to us, you know, about the way that we expect God to move and the way that we, you know, expect the move of God to look when he comes. I think, I imagine that this is a little bit like what it would have been like when everyone knew that the Earth was at the center of the solar system. My Earth science students know this, right? The Earth is not at the center of the solar system. If you were in Earth science with me in Mars Hill, you know this, right? Everyone knew that that was true, that the Earth was at the center of the solar system, and then all of a sudden you've got people like Galileo making a telescope and looking at Jupiter's moons and saying the Earth is not actually at the center of the solar system, right? I imagine that kind of dissonance is maybe a little bit of like what the Pharisees experienced. So we'll maybe give them a little bit of cut them a little slack in that response, in that respect, but they still obviously should have gotten it. But anyway, I think it's easier to be a Pharisee than you might think, is my point. And again, you know, the Pharisees did everything that they were doing to establish a kingdom of holiness, usher in the Messiah, and see the kingdom established in their midst. We are also interested in establishing the kingdom and seeing the kingdom extended. And we are also a community committed to holiness. So I think we have a little bit of vulnerability in that respect, and it's worthwhile consider who the Pharisees were, the traps that they fell into, and instead of following the Pharisees into those traps, following Jesus in this lifestyle of humility, grace, and mercy, ministering to the unclean, right? Okay, so I have three kind of basic application points that might resonate with you, and they map more or less to these three points. So first, the Pharisees avoided the unclean, but in doing so, they missed a lot of people who whose hearts were ready to receive the word, right? And if they had gone to them, maybe those people could have come into the kingdom, right? So the Pharisees, by avoiding ministering to certain people because they were unclean, actually kept people out of the kingdom. And so my question for us is to consider whether we ever avoid certain people because of how they seem on the outside, and maybe miss a chance to sow the word into a willing heart, into soil in somebody's heart that's actually really fertile and ready to receive the word and bear it with fruit. Do we ever avoid somebody or avoid sowing the word, broadly, because we don't maybe want to associate with somebody who's not like us, or we don't like them, or whatever, right? That's maybe question one. Number two, the Pharisees zealously followed the law, and in doing so, established customs and practices that actually countermanded the heart of the law. So question for us is whether we ever lose the distinction between the way that we do things, whoever we might be, that might be your family, that might be your home group, that might be your church, that might be just you personally. Do we ever lose the distinction between the way that we're doing things and the actual heart or the text or the spirit of the word from which that that choice or that action was originally derived? And I think about this a lot in child training. I don't want to train my children to behave like according to behavior. I want to train their hearts, right? And it's really hard to do, because you can't always tell what's going on in the heart. You know, it requires a lot of discernment. It requires a lot of extra effort. It requires prayerfulness. And it's not as easy as training to behavior, right? I think it's really easy, in maybe discipleship and child training alike, to fall into kind of considering behavior a proxy for the heart. But that's actually backwards, right? Like Matt shared a few weeks ago, the kingdom comes into the heart and does this inside-out sort of transformation, right, that bears fruit in behavior. So we really do need to be concerned about the heart. And then number three, the Pharisees enjoyed very comfortable lives, wealth, political power, prestige, recognition, and they weren't really interested in that comfort being disrupted. But Jesus humbled himself. He didn't establish or build a comfortable life, right? In one of the Gospels, when somebody asks him to follow him, or if somebody asks Jesus if he can follow him, Jesus says, "Foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." He didn't establish a comfortable life, right, and live to that. He humbled himself and continued to pour himself out to see others brought into the kingdom. And so I guess my question for us in this is, when the kingdom of God threatens our comfortable life, how do we respond to that, right? Like when God, Jesus shows up and calls us to set something aside to follow him and see the kingdom extended, like how closely do we hold on to whatever that kind of comfortable life, whatever that might be, how closely do we hold on to that? Or are we ready to lay it down to see the kingdom extended? Worship team, y'all can come on up. You maybe have found yourself falling into some of these traps of the Pharisees, gatekeeping the kingdom, following rules to keep up appearances, or living to your own comfort or benefit. But again, like Matt shared, the kingdom comes in the heart, and it works its way from the inside out, right? So we really do, need to meet Jesus, the person of Jesus, and have our hearts transformed, and then have that kingdom establish in our heart and bear fruit in our lives. And like Victor shared many weeks ago, I don't remember how many weeks ago, Jesus called people to follow him, the person, Jesus, and have a relationship with him, which is very different from like participating in a system or like following rules or doing the right things, right? It's relating to the person of Jesus. And I think we all know what inherently, or have maybe some experience that we understand what that's like to relate to a person versus like a system, right? So I want to remind us and invite us to encounter the person of Jesus, receive the word of God in our hearts, and see our lives transformed from the inside out, right? The Pharisees weren't able to do that, but we can, praise God. So if you're, if you're there in some way, shape, or form, and you want to come and pray about it, I'd love to pray with you. And let's follow Jesus together. Thank you. Amen.